This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome. This is Bill Campbell. We have with us guest Michael Card. You may know the name. He's a man who's been well known for many years with his music career. He's cut 31 albums. He's co-authored and authored also, though, some 24 books. You know him as a best-selling author, perhaps, but I haven't known so much of that side of Michael's life. I've been enjoying his music through the days, songs like El Shaddai, Love Crucified, A Rose, Emmanuel, many favorites of the Christian world. I didn't realize, Michael, how much you are involved deeply in theology, in a study, in a love for God. So thank you for joining us. This is going to be a very interesting program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yes. Let me tell you, listeners, before we dive in further here, just I want you to put something on your calendar. Michael's going to be local to our... I'm broadcasting out of Hendersonville, North Carolina. For listeners who are not local, you're interested. You may be interested also, but Michael's going to be here locally at the Billy Graham Center at the Cove, July 22nd to 26th. And I really want to encourage you to come. In fact, some of the topics we unfold here in the program during this hour, he will explore in much more depth. Do you want to say a word about what you'll be doing, Michael?
Yeah, I think what we're doing there, Bill, is we're intensively going through the Gospels and looking at what's unique about Matthew's presentation or Mark or any of the other Gospels. They all have uniquenesses about them, and we tend not to appreciate those as much as we should. And so I think what we're going to do is look at those uniquenesses and then let everyone do their homework and make their statement about, okay, who is Jesus? The Jesus that you've met in the Gospels, describe him to me. And I think that's other than getting it from someone else, I think we're supposed to put these things together ourselves. And so what I want to do is help people do that.
Fantastic. I'm fascinated by all of your work in the Gospels. And it seems to me, Michael, pretty obvious that what you've done, in fact, you say this some on your website. Listeners, just take some time to peruse michaelcard.com and see all the wonderful resources available. When you put a song together, behind that, there's so much research and study given to it, and 3 minutes is never enough, and so you've been writing articles.
Right.
That you've been putting things on DVD, and most of all, you've been writing books with some real depth. And to see what you've done in the Gospels is fascinating.
So, thanks. I was discipled by a wonderful man named William Lane, who was a Bible commentary writer, first-rate scholar. I was with him for 26 years. I was holding his hand when he died, as a matter of fact. And so a lot of what I'm doing is comes out of, I think, Bill's approach to the Scriptures. He said that we should engage with the Scripture at the level of the informed imagination. So we need to learn, we need to talk about what the imagination means. We need to understand it biblically. And we need to do our homework, and that's what Bill was an excellent example of, someone who had really done his homework well.
I've enjoyed some of Bill's resources, and just reading about your life together is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I know you put it down in a book, which I've not had the privilege of reading yet. I'm looking forward to that. Tell us just a word about the story you put down on print.
He was my principal professor all through school. I got an undergrad and a master's degree in biblical studies with him. But he was also the pastor of the church that I attended, which was an African-American church. He was giving leadership. He was a white guy, but he was giving leadership to a small black church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. So we were together every Sunday. He was the person that really first asked me to write music. He asked me one Sunday, he said, "You play the guitar, right?" And I said, "Sure." nobody was really doing Christian music as such then, at least not that I was aware of. And so he gave me his sermon, and for 6 years, off and on, and I wasn't the only person writing music. There were other people in our community who were writing music, too. But he would give me a sermon, and I would write a little chorus. So unbeknownst to me, I was being trained as a songwriter, even though I didn't want to be a songwriter. I just wanted to please Bill.
I love it.
And so then in 1998, he found out he had cancer. They'd given him 6 months to live. And he called me from Seattle. He was the head of the religion department at Seattle Pacific University. And he said, "I don't want to die here." He said, I want to come to Franklin and show you how a Christian man dies." So he moved into Franklin where we live, and he lived ended up living 18 really good months. He was strong right until the end, and he was discipling pastors and doing all sorts of stuff. And that's when we wrote that book together. Well, we were supposed to write the book together. He died before we finished, so I had to basically write it on my own.
Wow. You know, your book, A Sacred Sorrow, will be a big focus of our program today. And you don't mention much in the book, from what I've seen, about your own journey and how you came to this place. But I imagine your life with Bill Lane and watching him step into glory was a big part of that, was it?
It really was, because, first I had an 18-year-old nephew who died of cancer after a very long struggle. And Bill died just like a month or two afterwards. And then just shortly after that, my mother and my best friend died on the same day.
Wow.
It was just death. Yeah, it was death all around me. And I must say I've been pretty insulated from suffering, but I've been close to a lot of people who really did go through suffering. And I think the basic thing that every Christian does, it sooner or later, you start saying, okay, what's up with this, God? What is it that you're doing? Yeah, so I started looking at the laments in the Old Testament, and looking at the principal people who are the lamentors, Job, David, Jeremiah, and Jesus, and how lament functioned in their lives, how they were able to hold on to God through very difficult times by this very difficult conversation that lament really is. I mean, most of the Psalms are laments. Numerically, most of the Psalms say things to God like, where were you when I needed you, or why are you hiding your face from me? And American Christians, at least my experience has been that we haven't looked at those. We haven't taken those seriously. And so that's just me trying to take those things seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember one of my first mission trips. I went to South America. I was shocked, Michael, when we got stuck in a traffic jam, and our bus inched its way through what was actually a group, a whole community, a whole town, viewing a corpse, viewing a lost loved one. They made it a big public event. And here in America, in the West, we tend to hide our sorrows, our grief, our lament, and we keep funerals to an anesthetized minimum. You know, we don't want to get too emotional, many of us. I know you've done a lot of trips overseas, and you've got DVDs out on tying the biblical story with your own journeys. What have you seen? Do people tend to handle this lament experience better in other cultures than we do here?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, I think I was discipled in an African American church, and you know, we have Negro spirituals from that church, which are mostly laments. And yeah, you go to some place like China. I've been around and seen other cultures. In Asian cultures, supposedly tears are harder. It's harder for people from Asia to cry. It's supposed to be a more buttoned down kind of culture. But my experience in the Church of China, especially during their worship service, is that people are pretty free with their tears. And what they've learned is, I think, Bill, what we need to learn is that sometimes the thing that hurts you the most is the most precious thing you have to offer God. And it sounds like a bizarre idea, but it's very biblical. I ask people, you know, what is Jesus doing at the moment in his life when he's most being used by God? And the answer is, he's lamenting. You know, why have you forsaken me?
Wow.
And I think it's a fascinating idea that in your life and my life, that moment when we're most being used by God is the moment when we're lamenting, when by faith we're holding on. Of course, you discover that he's actually holding on to you, but you're not leaving the conversation because it's hard. You're not, someone has said, I'm not going to leave the dance floor till the music's over, because God is, he's committed to staying with me until the music's done. And that for me, this idea that the thing that hurts me the most might be the most precious thing I have to offer, that God uses suffering, you know, this way, that there's this redemptive piece of suffering, which, of course, is basic to Christianity. That's why we wear crosses around our necks, right? Mm-hmm. We understand that suffering can be redemptive, and I think in the end it's the best reason we have for worshiping God, that our sufferings aren't wasted.
Yes, and we wear the cross, but then when it comes to our own tears sometimes, especially as men, we want to put that aside. Don't show it. It's a sign of weakness. And I think about the four characters in your book, A Sacred Sorrow, Job, David, Jeremiah, and Jesus. And we see there that the first three encapsulate their stories in a poetic form, meaning there's so much thought as they put it on public display, and we want to hide it in a dark corner. Can you talk to us a little about wisdom literature and poetry? What makes this unique when it comes to lament?
Well, the interesting thing about wisdom literature is, and this is what I did my master's degree on, the wisdom literature isn't about wisdom. It's about the inadequacy of wisdom. Job, I mean, that book is all about the inadequacy of the wisdom of his friends and his wisdom. You know, Ecclesiastes, I mean, come on. The smartest guy in the world writes that book, and he says it's not about wisdom. Certainly there's wisdom in Proverbs, but Song of Solomon, you know, that's about the fact that there's something completely better than wisdom. And so what happens is, and again, I think this is what Job is all about, when you find out that wisdom is inadequate, then you've got to ask the question, well, okay, so what's it all about? So where do I go to? Who do I go to? And that's, you know, that's Job's question. And what happens is the answer becomes a person. The answer to all my pressing questions of suffering in my life, and why does this kid have cancer, and why did this baby die, the answer is not an answer. The answer is a person. The answer is God showing up.
Wow.
Job asks all these questions, right? And they're good questions. When God shows up at the end of the book, he doesn't answer a single one. The point is, God shows up. You know, the miracle of the book of Job is the movement of God. In chapter 1, he's on the throne. In chapter 42, he shows up. And all of that prepares us to meet Jesus. Jesus appears, the man of sorrows, who's familiar with our suffering. I think it's interesting that at one point they think he's Jeremiah, because I think he's so free with his tears. And him showing up, he's the answer. The incarnation is the answer. I'm working on the Gospel of John right now, and John bases his gospel on the wisdom writings, not so much on the law and the prophets. And it's the same, and I've never seen this until just the last month or two, it's the same dilemma in the Gospel of John. It's all about the fact that wisdom isn't enough. Nobody understands Jesus. Every single person he reveals himself to misunderstands, from starting with Nicodemus in the very first, you know, in the opening chapters. You know, Jesus says, you know, you must be born again. And what does Nicodemus say? Does a man enter his mother's womb a second time? You know, he's clueless. And so it's the same thing. It's the same, in many ways, it's like Job, that, you know, you find out our wisdom is not enough. We need a person, see? We need incarnation, and then you appreciate Jesus in a whole new way.
So Job, as you said so rightly, is full of questions, and the answer is found in God. But no intellectual answers. And I believe the younger generation in our country, we can give them labels like Gen X, Gen Y, whatever. People are living, growing up today in a broken society for many different reasons, and we need God more than ever. And some of us, who pastor types like me, we want to give our doctrinal answers. You know, here are the five steps to success. And God says, show them me. And Michael, I feel as though your book, A Sacred Sorrow, and many of your songs lead the way to bridge between a human who's experiencing this brokenness of sorrow and who wants to know God.
Yeah, and the more you think of it, I had a friend from Knoxville, actually, who was in a car wreck. He was T-boned by a drunk driver, and this guy was a pastor, so he knew how to lament. He knew his Bible, and so he is in the hospital in Knoxville, paralyzed from the neck down, and he is lamenting, you know, why God, why, you know, shaking his, well, he can't shake his fist because he's paralyzed, but in essence, shaking his fist at God. And then during that time, he had an experience of what he referred to as the immediacy of God's presence. He just felt, you know, he said, I thought someone had walked in the room. And this guy's a Presbyterian. Presbyterians don't often have these kind of experience. So anyway, he feels this presence, the immediacy of the presence of God. And then after a certain period of time, that presence left, not that God can ever leave, but sometimes our experience of the immediacy of his presence. And then he said, boy, that's when I began to lament. He said, I realized that I needed his presence more than I needed his provision. And he said, what I was praying was, you don't have to heal me. I'm fine with being paralyzed. Just don't leave me. Whatever you do, don't leave me.
Wow.
And he was eventually healed.
Wow.
But that's the thing. See, God showing up is the answer. And I think sometimes as pastors, we want to come into people's lives and fix them or give them answers with a small a. And what we have to do is I don't know, enter into their suffering the way Jesus does, redemptively enter into that suffering and kind of wait with them until God shows up. If we've got the courage to believe He really does, and I personally believe He really does.
Michael, I'll just share honestly that a lot of my brokenness as of late is knowing people I love in the what I call the younger generations, but these future leaders of our country, and realizing they've got questions for which I've not had any good answers.
Yes.
And it's really broken me down to humble myself and realize I need to listen.
Yes.
And hear their stories and learn where they're hurting. Learn what the questions are they're asking.
Yep. And I think they need to be listened to. And I think sometimes that's what they need more than anything. We talk about Bill Lane. Bill Lane used to say the best way to show someone you love them is to listen to them.
Mm.
And he said that's especially true with God. He said if you really want to show God you love Him, stop doing things for Him and listen to Him. And that's been a huge thing for me in terms of understanding or approaching the Bible. See, I believe I can show God. One of the ways I can show God how much I love Him is to listen to His Word. And you know, what is it? The Shema, the Deuteronomy 6: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That word for hear also can be translated listen. Listen, Israel. And then the very next verse starts with love. You love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. So I think that there's this connection between listening and loving. And we you're right, Bill. We got to do a better job of being redemptive, you know, listeners.
Job had friends who didn't listen very well.
Well, they did it first. I mean, for 7 days. I mean, let's give them credit.
Yeah.
For 7 days, they didn't.
That's
but
true.
They can't help it, can they?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a week is, you know, for me, 5 minutes would be a long time. They gave them a week, so I shouldn't get down on them.
No. They are good. These are good men. His friends are good men. Yeah.
Yeah. What suggestions do you have for us based on your study of Job for listening better? Are there any practical tips you can give to us?
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that we can learn from the book of Job and from his friends. I mean, I think you're right. They can't keep quiet any longer. And I think one reason they can't is that Job's suffering really intimidates them. See, they look at his life. Here's a good man who is an innocent man. And by the way, the book of Job is not about, it's not a test to whether God can see whether Job's going to be faithful or not. God knows from the very beginning it's going to be faithful. But his friends are intimidated by his suffering that they can't explain. And I think if you're listening to this program today and you're going through suffering, you may have friends that are good people, but they're intimidated by the fact that you're suffering, and they want to explain it away somehow. They either want to fix you or they want to explain it away. And I think that's one thing that I think you can learn from the book of Job about this business of redemptively listening, because they were doing fine until they opened their mouths. And then at the end of the book, you know, God condemns them. In fact, it's interesting, God says to Job's friends, you know, you offer sacrifice, and then you pray to Job, or you ask Job to pray to me. Job becomes their intercessor, because God says what Job says about me is right. And the truth is, Job said some pretty bad things about God when he was lamenting. He said that God didn't care for him, and God didn't love him, and that sort of thing. Of course, that's not true. But they were still things that needed to be said. Yeah, I think there's so much that we can learn about listening, especially from Job and his friends. The other thing I think you see is that when Job's friends start talking, you can almost measure it. He stops talking, or he starts talking to God less and less. His laments get shorter and shorter, and the sections of him engaging and theologizing with his friends get longer and longer. So in essence, at the end, he does give up. That God has forsaken him, that God has hidden from him, I'm exhausted in your presence, that kind of stuff. And, of course, that's right when he's about to let go is when God shows up.
So good advice for us could be, if you want to speak well to someone who is suffering, listen.
yeah, absolutely. And, of course, and that's not to say that, if, you know, at some point God might give us a word. I don't want to deny all that stuff because it's true. Well, a word, you know, I just looked at the passage in Isaiah 50 that talks about that God gave him this ability to speak the word that sustains the weary. So we're not denying that either, but I think it's a pretty fair assumption that most of the time we speak too quickly.
David was a man who understood lament. Now, there are all kinds of psalms, aren't there? Help us with a sense of the... I mean, it's almost like a whole library in itself. Help us understand this, that we tend to think, okay, there's this book we call the Psalter, and I like some of them, I don't like others.
Yeah, right. Well, me too. Definitely ones I don't like. The really honest ones I don't like. And David tends to be, although Asaph does some pretty intense ones, David is the one who speaks these psalms. It's interesting that when Jesus is suffering on the cross, he goes to the Psalms to get the words he needs. Now, people might say, well, David prophetically heard Jesus say these things, and I'm fine with that too. I'm not denying that. But you know, when Jesus is on the cross, he's quoting the Psalms, David had some sort of a disease. We don't know what it is. We call them the disease laments, and most of the disease laments are the prophetic ones that apply to the cross. But initially, David was suffering some kind of sickness. And he describes the different, you know, his tongue cleaving to the roof of his mouth and all that stuff. But the worst part of his suffering, if you look towards the end of those disease laments, most of the time David talks about that he has people that are standing around him saying just what Job's friend said, you must have done something wrong. He refers to him as lions that are tearing him apart. And once again, you take that into a pastoral perspective, and you realize that there are people who are suffering, that the worst part of their suffering isn't the cancer. The worst part of their suffering is people in their community who come to them and say, you must have done something wrong or you wouldn't be suffering.
Wow, yes.
Which is a complete misunderstanding of how God works in the world.
Mm. I have a deaf son, and a friend who then had a deaf child came to us, and they said, help us out. They said, when we learned our child was deaf, we're in our church, and the church rejected us, saying you don't have enough faith, or this child would have been healed by now. And I just broke my heart, you know, because I know many deaf people have been healed. Our own son wasn't, and prophetically, people would come up and say he's going to have a ministry, and now he's out doing Bible translation to help other deaf people know Jesus. And so here's David, a man who suffered much.
Well, can I say one thing real quick?
Yeah.
Interesting, you know, that's another point of I think what we can learn about suffering. Because you have a deaf child, you're uniquely qualified to speak into the lives of other people. That's why someone who has a deaf child came to you, right?
Yes.
You're uniquely qualified. I tell people, you've had cancer. My sister had lost two babies, born full term and then died after they were born. Unfortunately, you are now uniquely qualified. Your son is uniquely qualified through what he suffered to then, you know, encourage other people, and people will listen to him that will never listen to me or listen to you, right? He's uniquely qualified. And what does the Bible tell us about Jesus as our high priest, Hebrews? He's uniquely qualified. Why? Because he suffered.
Yeah.
And that's a whole, there's this whole other purpose that suffering has that people, the sort of easy believism, they just can't seem to grasp this. And isn't it odd that a Christian community can't understand how God would use suffering? I mean, with crosses around our necks, where God's, you know, God uses the suffering of his son to save the world. And yet, when suffering comes into our lives, we, you know, there's something wrong. What did Jesus do wrong?
Yeah.
And certainly, sometimes we do suffer as a result of our own sin. And David talks about that too in Psalm 51.
Yes. Yeah. We're going to take just a short break here. Michael, listeners, this is Michael Card. And you may have known, as I did, and loved his music for decades, 30-year career. But did you know that he's a theologian first, and that drives all that he does, including his singing and the writing of 30-some books? So hold on. We're going to be right back after this short break.
You are listening to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. To discover more about Beyond Words and the other ministries of Scripture Awakening, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com. While there, you can learn about our amazingly successful Bible reading program, B90, or Bible in 90 Days. You can review the extensive catalog of our versatile Bible study series titled Be Next. You can also download free podcasts from all Beyond Words programs.
Check out B90, Be Next, and Beyond at scriptureawakening.com. Here once again is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
And this is Bill Campbell. We have with us Michael Card, who's well known as having a ministry of music, and as an author, he's had a great impact. He also travels a lot. He speaks at conferences. He speaks in churches. He's going to be at the Cove, in fact, in just a few weeks, July 22nd to 26th. If you're a local, be sure to join in and catch him there. Michael, I noticed on your website the Biblical Imagination Series. Can you describe that briefly before we dive back into our topic?
Sure. The series, it's a series on the Gospels, and I've done the Synoptics. I'm doing John right now. And it's a book, it's a record of songs, and it's a teaching video from Israel on each one of the Gospels, what's unique about them, kind of major themes. Mm-hmm. And it's at the same time, it's really as much a book about or a project about how to study the Bible. So we do conferences, weekend conferences, and which is a lot like what we're going to do at the Cove. And we actually for the first time this December we took a group to Israel. We take like 30 people at a time and actually go to all the places or the main places in the Gospels. So I've always tried to get music listeners to become readers, or readers to become listeners. And I've tried it for 30 years. I don't think I've done a very good job of it. But in the end, it's still, I think it's helpful, because people who do listen to music, you know, I can catch them in my net a little bit, and people that do read books, I can catch them with a book. So, you know, I think God still uses it, just not the way that I was hoping.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a story of life with God, isn't it? Always a new surprise.
Yeah. Somebody says you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. So I had this had this plan. Oh yeah, this is gonna be great. People who read books are also gonna start appreciating music more, and people who, you know, and that never worked. But anyway.
Well, I hope listeners that like me, if you've been listening to music, could get into more of Michael's books, and vice versa. So we're thinking about the book and associated music, but the book title is Sacred Sorrow. And we've talked some about Job. We're coming into the Psalms now, and I notice at the end of your book, you encourage people to write their own lament.
Yeah.
Talk to us for a minute about that, because we like to read the laments at times when they fit into our lives, but writing a lament, that's kind of a new challenge for some of us.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good exercise, first of all, to understand how laments work, because there's a couple of things that tend to happen in the laments in the Bible. I think Psalm 72 is kind of the roadmap. It's the best example. I think it's Psalm 72. Let me open my Bible real quick, make sure. But it's sort of a roadmap of how laments are put together. And what tends to happen is, a lament begins with your suffering, right? With your talking about your suffering, and there's a lot of I's and me's and my's, and that's why Psalm 72 is Psalm 73. I'm glad I looked myself up. Yeah, Psalm 73 is kind of the middle psalm in the Psalter. It's the first psalm in Book 3. There are four books of the Psalms. They're collected into a sub-collection, and it starts. Laments start out, understandably, with why are you letting me suffer, and my suffering and my pain and that sort of thing. And that's appropriate. I think God wants you to lift those things up as an act of worship to him. But what inevitably happens in all the Psalms except one, Psalm 88 is the only psalm that doesn't do it, but all the other ones resolve. The Book of Lamentations resolves too. Mm-hmm. About halfway through around chapter 4, the verse in Lamentations says, because of your hesed, because of your mercy, you know, we're not consumed. And what happens is you make this turn, and in 70, Psalm 73, the turn is really obvious, you know, until I went into the sanctuary. So you lament, then something happens, and what happens is God shows up, just like Job. There's this experience of the presence of God. And after all this complaining, he's complaining about wicked people, he's complaining about his own life, all this bitterness, then the last part of 73 is, you know, who do I have in heaven but you? And desiring nothing, you know, I have nothing but you. You hold me by my right hand. And you, I ask the question, is this the same guy that wrote the first several verses? It sounds like this is a different person. And what happens, I think, Bill, is that you exhaust yourself. And 73, by the way, is a psalm of Asaph. It's not a psalm of David. Asaph has exhausted himself against God. And then this turn happens from I to thou. And what happens when you write your own laments, it's interesting how that tends to happen automatically. There's always this very redemptive turn that happens, and you look back at God and you realize things. It happens in Job. I mean, at the end, you know, Job says, you know, my ears had heard about you, but now my eyes see you. He has this real experience of the presence of God. Mm-hmm. And all of the laments do that. So that's why it's helpful to write one on your own.
And Michael, if someone is not into writing, they don't journal, they just don't pick up the pen or type on a keyboard often, maybe the parallel would be talking to God and just opening your heart up. And if it takes hours, pour it out to Him.
Absolutely. I think it can happen in prayer. And it ideally, you know, it should happen in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But what you need to do, though, people need to realize that they have the permission. I say it this way. Anything you need to say to God, you can say to God. Nowhere in the Bible does God tell any of His children, how dare you speak to me that way. Mm-hmm. He says it one time to some Philistines in the Old Testament. But otherwise, you know, you are free to say anything you need to say. And if you can't find the words, they're for you. The words are there for you in the Psalms.
A close, I think, parallel to the lament Psalms are the imprecatory Psalms.
Yes.
And you're telling me that if I get mad at God because I'm hurt, I'm not going to knock Him off His throne.
Absolutely. I mean, the imprecatory Psalms are laments.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, smash the infant's heads against the rock. And it's these prayers where we take our anger. And people will say, and I'm sure there are people listening, they're going to be upset that I'm saying this, but what happens is the psalmist is taking his anger, sometimes even his anger at God, and offering it up as an act of worship. And all of those imprecatory psalms, they all transition. Yeah. Blessed is the man who bathes his feet in the blood of his enemies. That is in the Psalter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's as though David gives us permission to get the stuff out from within our heart so that we can be healed.
Yeah, and let me say this too. This is not about getting it off your chest.
Mm.
This is not about psychology. This is about worshiping God well. Mm. And what I think we have to realize is that, I mean, the word worship means worth-ship. It's celebrating the worth of God. And what we have to realize is that only God is worth, you know, unburdening ourselves in this way too. We offer up the thing that hurts us the most, and sometimes your anger is the thing that hurts you the most, or your confusion, or your disappointment. And again, for me, this is a completely new idea, but you look into the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, and it's there, it's everywhere. But it's there in the New Testament too. You know, Paul is lamenting the thorn in his flesh. He's lamenting that business. And what happens? God does not take it away, but God shows up, you know? So, It's a pretty consistent thing that you see all the way through. You see it certainly in Jeremiah, same thing. That, you know, the weeping prophet who is in essence destroyed. He's the only prophet who's really destroyed by what he prophesied. He sees the destruction of Jerusalem and that sort of thing. And but in the end, you know, there's this wonderful transition, and he has an experience with God that he would not have had otherwise. And it is a powerful, to me, it's a powerful idea.
You know, people look at David, they say, he's a great triumphant man, a victor, great king overall. You know, don't tell me about the lament, but it was the valley that created the space for the mountains, for the high experiences with God. And Jeremiah too, isn't it true? I've heard it said Jeremiah must have been a very pliable, flexible, meek man. And it's because he was that he was able to go through so much suffering at this critical time in the history of Israel and come out strong through it.
Yeah.
You know, he allowed himself to experience the pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the pain that God uses. It's suffering that he uses. And for people that see Christianity just as this relationship where God gives me things, you're completely missing the real blessing. Because what happens is, what you see in someone like Job, well, in all of them, what happens is God strips things away. I tell people he's not the God who gives me things, he's the God who takes everything away. Certainly Jeremiah experienced that. Until what you realize is that in a way you would have never realized it otherwise, is that he's the only thing you need. It'd be awesome if God would heal the cancer, and sometimes he does. You know, certainly, he can do, part of being God, he can do whatever he wants to do. But sometimes he uses the cancer. I mean, with my mentor, Bill Lane, he died of multiple myeloma. And Bill would say, you know, he's not the God of the magic wand. He's the God who enters redemptively into my suffering, which, as far as I'm concerned, is far more miraculous.
Yes. Now, Michael, there are some listening who they're charismatic, Pentecostal in their orientation. I'm not putting any label on it right now, but some in that camp might say that God doesn't allow suffering. If we just have enough faith, we can avoid it.
Yeah.
And how do you speak to that person?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of charismatics who understand suffering, so I don't want to just shut the door on them. But in general, this whole, I call it the prosperity gospel, and the prosperity gospel has infiltrated Presbos and Baptists and all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's that this idea that God exists to give me things, which is, you know, diametrically opposed to the fundamental gospel, which says, ask not what you can do for your country, or ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I mean, even Kennedy got this. This idea being that I take up the cross, I exist, you know, I become a person who lives for other people, not for myself, not for what God can do for me. And somehow, if you can't see that that's the Christian life, that that's the, being a slave to Christ, which is the word that all of his followers use in the New Testament, Paul and Peter and James and all of them, they see themselves, and Jesus uses the term to himself. If you don't see that, you're missing a fundamental piece of the gospel. Mm-hmm. Does God bless us with things? Absolutely. God gives us your next breath, okay? If he didn't give you your next breath, you're going to drop dead like a hammer. He gives us all kinds of stuff. Is he the God blesses? Absolutely. But he's a God who, I think, wants to bless us. The greatest blessing we can have is to know him. Yes. And part of the process of knowing him in this fallen, death-impregnated world is to redemptively engage with suffering, our own suffering or the suffering of other people. In Paul in Romans, when he talks about love must be sincere, the very next idea is that you weep with those who weep. So, and I think that's one place where the prosperity people tend to really miss where they might have an impact, because if you're suffering, then they really have nothing to say to someone who's suffering other than the fact that you don't have enough faith. That there's this whole, you miss out on this whole opportunity to talk about the sufferings of Jesus and redemption
You know, well, as we look at prophets, we love Isaiah. We love his poetic words and his prophetic speech about Christ. We love the miraculous of an Elijah or an Elisha. We come to Jeremiah, and this guy shows no great miracles. He's shedding tears. You know, we don't want this sadness. You know, and yet it's there in the Bible. There are seasons and times for everything. And I think there are parts of the body of Christ that sort of get this part of theology. Others get that part, and when we're healthiest, when we get it all together.
Sure.
Michael, are there sectors of the body of Christ, either as you look around the world today from your experience or through history, you'd like to point to as ones who really understood the suffering side of God's heart?
Well, it's the suffering church. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in China with men and women from the underground church. You know, I think primarily, but I used to go to Romania. I haven't been there in a long time, but the Christians there suffered under Ceausescu for so long. It's the churches that have, sort of come to grips with and redemptively embraced suffering and understood, you know, this idea that God uses it and he saves the world. He uses suffering to save the world. That's the good news. And Paul, I mean, even our suffering, which I can't explain this, when Paul says that he's going to make up, you know, what's lacking in the suffering of Jesus, I have no idea what that means other than the fact that because of the incarnation, because you and I are part of his body now, that my suffering, I mean, this is one of the best reasons for worshiping. My suffering can actually have purpose. Mm. So if God forbid, if I get cancer, but if and when I do, you know, I can be sure that God's either going to heal me, or I can certainly be sure that He's going to use it. Mm. You know, if I'll let Him. And you know, I'll have this marvelous door, or whatever the suffering is. I'll have this marvelous door to speak to people who would never listen to me otherwise. That really is good news, that your suffering, your tears aren't wasted. The psalmist says that God treasures our tears. He saves them in a little bottle, and He writes down each one in a book. Mm. I mean, what an incredible image that is.
Yes, we think of the tears in the bottle. It's like God treasures every single one.
Yeah.
And then I think of Jeremiah's Lamentations. He wrote this short little book, and we find in the Hebrew, it's a form of poetry that is the acronym, the acrostic,
right?
ABC, as you know.
Right.
And it's so carefully woven together, it's like it's been stylized and carefully massaged for through a generation, maybe. And you look at that, and it's like they're capturing, not now the tears, but the reason for the tears, they're capturing it in a book to never be forgotten.
Yep, and Jeremiah is read every year. You know, within Judaism, they read the whole book.
Yeah,
every year. But that great transition. I can't remember. I know it's in chapter 4, maybe it's 4:11. I'm looking in my Bible right here to try to find it.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, it transitions when it says, "Because of your hesed," and that word, that Hebrew word hesed, is so important. It's the word that God uses to define Himself. We translate it. Well, it's translated 14 different ways. King James, had to even make up a word. Loving kindness is a word that was totally made up by the King James translators to translate this word that defines who God is. But what happens in most of the Psalms, or a lot of the Psalms, when the transition happens, this word hesed appears. You know, forgive me because of your hesed, David says. Surely goodness and hesed will follow me all the day of my life. What does God require of you, O man, but to do justice, love, hesed. It's a very important word. And the way I translate it is, it's when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing gives me everything. Wow. And that, when a suffering person realizes that that's who God is, He's the father of the prodigal son. The prodigal son doesn't get a second chance. He gets a ring and shoes and a party and a robe. You know, when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing, we have a right to expect nothing from God. And lo and behold, He gives me everything. You know, the prosperity people are right in this way. He is the God who wants to give us everything, but what He wants to give us is Himself.
Yes.
And how miraculous is that? Mm. Gee whiz.
Wow. Yeah, it's easy to settle on hesed with a simple definition like loving kindness. I love what you're saying.
But the wonderful thing about hesed is it's untranslatable. You cannot translate it. Most of Jesus' parables is He's trying to translate it. I mean, the prodigal son is the perfect translation of hesed. The good Samaritan, again, when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing, the Samaritan, gives me everything. It's this idea of the fact that God wants us to come to Him, like Bartimaeus at Mark. Bartimaeus is the great example in Mark. Bartimaeus is asking for hesed. When he says, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy," that's hesed he's asking for. And what Jesus, I think, is always excited about is when we ask Him for what we know we don't deserve. That exchange is the cool exchange. See, I come to Jesus and I'm willing to beg for what I know I don't deserve. That's when you're asking for mercy. And that's, Bill, that's huge. I mean, that's the gospel. That's the gospel.
Mm. As we come now to Jesus, I shared of my own weakness. I mentioned a deaf son. Well, before I knew he was deaf, he was a little straddling baby, grew up as a toddler, and I was traveling the world speaking, didn't want to do pastoral stuff because I would have to deal with grieving and sorrow, and I couldn't explain it, but I just didn't have that in me. I didn't want to experience that part, you know? But it wasn't fair to him, and then another child coming, you know, to be gone so much. So I felt I should take a pastor, but God, I can't do this. Then I get a phone call, and it's people saying, look, we're deaf. We got to have someone do the funeral. You know, sign language, your pastor, come. I'd say, don't do funerals. You know, so
you are uniquely qualified.
And they keep calling me and calling me. So finally, I gave up and went, and I found such joy there.
Yep.
What can you say to the listener who, like me, in my past, I don't anymore, but I was running from this thing of sorrow and grief. I didn't see it as sacred. How does Jesus help us overcome that?
Well, I mean, I don't think I can do a better example than what you just did. I mean, I tell this to the cancer survivors, to the whatever, the incest survivors, to the people who have come through the other side of, you know, incredible suffering. And most of the people who come through it, they sort of realize this, you know, sooner or later on their own. They don't need someone like me who hasn't suffered to tell them this. The good news is that, you know, God is going to use the deafness of your son to bring him glory. Whenever Jesus is confronted with death and disease, like the disciples say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus says, it's nobody sinned. It's for the glory of God. Lazarus dies, you know, and nobody seems to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And Jesus goes, no, this is for the glory of God. And so Jesus looks at suffering and sin as an opportunity for God's glory to be revealed. Now, he raises Lazarus and he heals the man who's born blind. But I think, you know, I think the point is God uses everything to bring him praise. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes he doesn't heal the deaf child, or maybe he allows him to perceive and to hear in ways that are much more significant than auditory, and so he ends up doing translations or something. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You see God, his redemption breaking through suffering, all through the Bible and all through, I think, throughout life. The suffering church understands this, and I can't give a better example than the one you just gave.
Mm. Well, you wrote a whole book on the cross, and there was the ultimate example, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Say a word to us about how sacred sorrow becomes on that cross.
Well, God, you know, God uses your suffering, he uses my suffering in a redemptive way, and the ultimate example is that he uses the suffering of his own son. He uses that. God doesn't, when Jesus comes, you know, he could have written his name in the stars, he could have, you know, come in and blasted the powers of the world at that point. He could have come and wiped out Rome and set up a kingdom in Israel and done his thing. But that, you know, we've got to look carefully at how, when God comes to us, how does he come? He comes in weakness, right? Paul says Jesus was crucified in weakness. And nothing about him that would attract us to him. He comes and he's so free with his tears, people confuse him with Jeremiah. He's a very emotional person, and Mark is the gospel that gives us really the emotional life of Jesus more than any other gospel. And he uses suffering. He's drawn to people who are suffering. You know, he enters into their suffering redemptively. He does weep with, we see him weeping with people that are weeping. Martha and Mary are the prime example there. And it's that life that God uses to change everything. I mean, everything, I mean, and that's what Luke is all about, the fact that Jesus has turned the world upside down. It is a completely new ball game. So what was perceived as weakness is now great strength.
Wow.
You know, Jesus says, hey, I've come to show that people who are blind can see, and people who say they see will end up being blind. Mm. Everything's turned upside down. And I tell people this, you know, we still have no idea of the degree to which this man has turned the world upside down. It is not business as usual. Everything's different. You know, Jesus says in John, you know, I've come to show them that they're wrong about, you know, all these things, judgment and all the, you know, I forget what the three terms are, but he uses them there in John. The whole world has been turned upside down. And that for me is the fascinating thing then about looking at the Gospels and seeing just how he does that. You know, he doesn't didactically teach and make it crystal clear. He says things in parables so that we have to engage with our imaginations or we won't get it. When Jesus says, let he who has ears to hear, let him hear, that's his way of saying, if you don't really listen, you're not going to get this. And most of them didn't get it.
Yes.
Here's the wisdom of God in flesh, and yet he comes, and he's not this glorious teacher. I mean, if you reduce Jesus to saying, oh, he was this great teacher, well, guess what? The Gospel of John says, you know, most people didn't get it. If he was a better teacher, he, you know, he could have somehow found the right handouts or the whatever. Wow. But the thing is, he's coming in such a fundamentally different way, unexpected way, you know, using the foolish things of the world. Just like Paul. Paul does it the same way, and we're supposed to do it the same way, too. So we come in our weakness. You come with your deaf child. Mm-hmm. I come with my struggle with depression and a couple of moments in my life when I almost committed suicide. I come with my weakness. Mm-hmm. And he uses that to make it strong. When I come in my strength, he doesn't seem to do his thing. But you know this as a pastor. If you come in your weakness, it's unbelievable what God does.
Well, our time has run out. I hate to say that. Maybe we can get you on the air again sometime in the future,
sure.
Michael. This has been fantastic. Listeners, be sure to check out Michael at his website. Just Google Michael Card. You'll find him all over the place. And if you can, again, join him and hopefully us. I hope I can be there at the Billy Graham Center at the Cove. This July 22nd to 26th, you can go on the website at the Cove to sign up for that event. Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, thank you. It's been so fun. It's been really energizing talking to you, Bill. I appreciate it.
God bless.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.